Welcome to the 28th episode of Ankh Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Ankh Live On Air is a podcast from Ankh Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Ankh Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Ankh Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Minneapolis, Minnesota for a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer. At the meeting, topics range from surgical approaches for node-positive breast cancer to the use of CDK4/6 inhibitors in hormone receptor-positive disease to emerging drug therapies in triple-negative disease. Presenters also highlighted treatment approaches for those with lymphedema, discussed the use of proton beam radiation in breast cancer, and examined treatment de-escalation in the curative setting for those with HER2-positive disease. Concerns over false negative rates with sentinel lymph node biopsies have prevented the widespread adoption of sentinel lymph node surgeries in patients with node-positive breast cancer, but according to Judy C. Bogie, MD, improvements in surgical techniques and the development of neoadjuvant therapies have allowed for wide eligibility for the procedure. We sat down with Bogie, who is the chair of the Division of Surgery Research at the Mayo Clinic, who further highlighted new surgical strategies for the management of patients with node-positive breast cancer.
Women who have node-positive breast cancer, often they are treated with neoadjuvant chemotherapy, meaning chemotherapy delivered prior to surgery. And when patients have involvement of the lymph nodes at their initial presentation, the standard up until several years ago was that at the time of surgery, they would have all of their lymph nodes resected with an axillary lymph node dissection. There have now been several prospective trials conducted both in America, Canada, and in Europe, looking at whether we can avoid doing a full axillary dissection and identify those patients where the chemotherapy has effectively transitioned the lymph nodes from being positive to negative and allow those patients just to have a few lymph nodes removed with what's called a sentinel lymph node surgery, and then limit the use of axillary lymph node dissection for those women who still have disease in their lymph nodes after neoadjuvant chemotherapy. Those three trials all showed a false negative rate, meaning an error rate, around about 10 to 14% depending on the trial. And since those trials have been published, there have been a lot of ongoing advances in terms of how can we improve the technique to really drive that false negative rate as low as possible to make the procedure as safe as possible for patients. So some examples of those techniques would be things like making sure that the surgeon uses dual tracer, meaning usually a radioactive colloid and a blue dye, as that increases the identification rate of the sentinel node and also decreases the false negative rate associated with sentinel lymph node surgery. Another technique is using a clip that can be placed by the surgeon or the radiologist at the time of the needle biopsy prior to chemotherapy in the positive lymph node. And then when the sentinel lymph node surgery is performed after chemotherapy, making sure that that clipped node is removed. A third technique that is being widely adopted is the use of immunohistochemistry, so encouraging our pathologists to look a little bit closer at the sentinel lymph node and identify what might be just small volumes of disease, just isolated tumor cells or foci of disease that are less than a millimeter in size, less than 0.2 millimeters in size even, and considering those patients as node positive and proceeding with an axillary lymph node dissection.
Next, we sat down with Matthew P. Goetz, MD, chair of the Breast Cancer Disease-Oriented Group and co-leader of the Women's Cancer Center at the Mayo Clinic. FDA approvals of three CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib, have added important treatment additions to the armamentarium for patients with HR-positive breast cancer. But according to Goetz, future research will focus on defining mechanisms of acquired resistance to these agents. In our interview, Goetz discussed the impact of these inhibitors in the field and shared his approach for choosing which agent to use for these patients.
One thing that we've seen is that the CDK4/6 inhibitors have impacted the field in a number of different ways. First of all, is we look across the three CDK4/6 inhibitors that have been approved, which is palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib, we see essentially very similar hazard ratios and similar absolute benefits. These are not small benefits, but are actually relatively large. In fact, gains of that are actually approximate a full year. And the thing about we know about these CDK4/6 inhibitors is they're generally actually quite well tolerated. So when we think about the gains that we're achieving with these drugs, we're doing it in such a way that we're quality of life is actually not being detrimentally affected. The fact that we have three CDK4/6 inhibitors and the fact that they're actually slightly different in many ways is actually a good thing for clinicians. So palbociclib is a CDK4/6 inhibitor in which one of the main side effects that we see is neutropenia. Now, the neutropenia generally is not problematic in the sense that we don't really see severe infections, but it can cause dose delay, dose reductions. But that's probably the thing that we see most commonly. In contrast, let's say for abemaciclib, that particular drug, the most common side effect we see is diarrhea. And so, and actually neutropenia is actually much less of a problem. So we can actually, as clinicians, use the fact that these drugs have potentially different, they do have different side effect profiles, and we can use that to actually individualize patients. There are, for the three CDK4/6 inhibitors, there are some toxicities, let's say, that are unique. For example, abemaciclib has a slight increased risk for venous thromboembolic events. And so as a clinician, if I had a patient that had either a strong family history or personal history, I might steer away from that particular drug. Palbociclib does have obviously the issue with regard to neutropenia. And if I have a patient that I'm having difficulty dosing or maintaining on that drug, I might switch to palbociclib. Ribociclib actually has a side effect profile that's not too dissimilar from palbociclib in the fact that neutropenia is fairly common. It has a unique side effect or unique possibility that one has to follow, and that's the issue of QT prolongation. So that's just something that clinicians need to be aware of as they're prescribing ribociclib.
Jumping to triple negative disease, we also spoke with Roberto A. Leon Ferre, MD, an oncologist at the Mayo Clinic. Leon Ferre explained how the use of PARP inhibitors, antibody drug conjugates, and immunotherapies all have shown significant activity in select subgroups of patients with TNBC. However, he stressed that greater insight into the genomics and proteomics responsible for driving tumor growth are needed to inform the development of novel therapeutics. In our interview, he highlighted how the biology of TNBC has informed its management.
I think that the main message that I want to convey is that it is an incredibly exciting time to be an oncologist that treats triple negative breast cancer patients, because we are starting to see for the first time that a lot of the preclinical work, a lot of the laboratory research that has been done over many years is finally being translated to clinic. And we are seeing just recently, as a matter of fact, we just saw the results of a clinical trial incorporating immunotherapy to traditional chemotherapy and the treatment of patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer. And for the very first time, we see an overall survival improvement with a regimen in this disease. And it is the first immunotherapy to prove a benefit in the clinic. So this regimen is likely to be approved by the FDA soon, and we hopefully will have it available to use in clinic. So, you know, we're seeing advances in immunotherapy. Recently, in the last couple of years, we've seen the first targeted therapies approved for triple negative breast cancer with the approval of the PARP inhibitors for patients that have germline BRCA mutations. That set a really significant milestone in triple negative breast cancer by being the first targeted therapy, non-chemotherapy drug being approved for this patient population with triple negative breast cancer. And we're seeing a great deal of activity with new classes of drugs, including antibody drug conjugates. There's several antibody drug conjugates that are in different phases of development, some closer to being potentially approved if they definitively prove efficacy, and some of them being granted FDA breakthrough therapy designation. And along with all of those, there's also a lot of activity in trying to understand some of the molecular drivers of triple negative breast cancer, and we will be seeing more targeted therapies being developed and potentially even repurposing of the endocrine therapies that may have some activity in triple negative breast cancer, and I'll cover some of that today.
Next, we sat down with Oscar J. Manrique, MD, a plastic surgeon at the Mayo Clinic. He stressed the importance of early diagnosis and management of lymphedema. The most common approach used to combat the adverse event is treating patients during axillary lymph node dissection by performing a prophylactic bypass. However, the challenge is that many of these procedures are palliative. Manrique calls for more of a multidisciplinary treatment approach for these patients in order to improve outcomes. In this clip, Manrique highlights how to determine the optimal treatment approach for a patient and provides insight on the challenges that still need to be addressed.
So I talked about the anatomy, physiology and physiopathology of the lymphatic system, and the algorithm of treatment, imaging techniques of how to diagnose objectively someone with lymphedema, and then the surgical modalities, medical treatment, physical therapy, and surgical interventions, which are physiologic, lymphovenous bypass, vascular lymph node transfers, and excisional procedures, which are liposuction or Charles or modified Charles procedures. Our gold standard is to try to intervene early and do what's called physiological procedures, lymphovenous bypasses or vascularized lymph node transfers. And even now, we're trying to do prophylactic LV bypasses during axial lymph node dissection with reverse mapping. So we see the lymphatics that are leaking and try to connect those with veins. but most of the time, the patients that I see are those that already have lymphedema. So most of these procedures are palliative. Still, at this point, there's no cure for patients with lymphedema. Hopefully, we can see that in the next several years. But something that we can see is that they have an improvement overall in their quality of life and on their limb volume. So it's something that it was promising for patients. So as I explained, I think the key is to intervene early. So our goal will be to do the physiological procedures because they're easier. They require microsurgical techniques, which could be a little bit challenging, but overall, someone who's trained in microsurgery should be able, and with a good training, should be able to do these procedures. But we don't want to let lymphedema go all the way up to a higher stage, because then to reverse it is going to be really hard. So we want to attack the problem in an earlier stage.
Kimberly S. Corbin, MD, a radiation oncologist at the Mayo Clinic, stopped by to discuss the advantages of using proton beam radiation over standard radiation in certain patients with breast cancer. According to Corbin, proton therapy offers a precise approach and standard radiation can be risky in certain patients. In our interview, Corbin walks us through how proton therapy differs from standard radiation and which patients benefit most from radiation techniques with protons.
So proton therapy is particles compared to standard radiation, which is X-rays or photons. By way of kind of their physical properties, by being particles, they're heavier and they have different dosimetric characteristics. And what that enables us to do is actually better spare normal tissue from radiation therapy. So usually when X-rays interact with tissues therapeutically, they deposit energy along their path, and there's something called entrance dose and exit dose. But proton therapy's unique dosimetric characteristic is that it has very little exit dose from radiation. And so we can do a nice job of shaping the dose while maximally sparing non-target tissue from radiation. So I take care of breast cancer patients primarily, and that's kind of the context by which I'll answer that question, although I think proton therapy could apply to many different types of malignancies, and particularly those proximal to critical structures or patients who are particularly vulnerable to the side effects of radiation therapy like children. But for breast cancer patients, I think that there's strong value for patients who have the need for comprehensive target volume coverage. So generally, it's patients who have the need for deep nodal boosts or patients who have a unique anatomy that make standard radiation therapy potentially higher risk when it comes to normal tissues at risk. And at the other end of the spectrum, I think proton therapy may actually also have a role for women with early stage breast cancer who are interested in a type of treatment called accelerated partial breast irradiation. That type of treatment is very focused and used to target small volumes of tissue. And there may be some relationship between the volume of normal tissue, breast tissue exposed to radiation, and the long-term cosmetic outcome for partial breast irradiation. So, In that way, for that population, I think by really being able to accurately limit the dose to a smaller volume, there may be a role in that setting also.
For our last interview, we spoke with Sierra O'Sullivan, MB, BCH, who discussed how treatment de-escalation for patients with HER2-positive breast cancer is not only feasible, but imperative. Sullivan, a family physician at Mayo Clinic, provided insight on how HER2-targeted treatment can be more individualized and explore the biggest challenges that remain in tailoring treatment for this patient population.
HER2 amplification is seen in approximately 50 to 20% of patients, and prior to the advent of adjuvant trastuzumab, patients were noted to have a more aggressive clinical course and poorer outcomes. Since the advent of the monoclonal antibody trastuzumab and the newer HER2-directed therapies, there has been a dramatic improvement in treatment in both adjuvant and metastatic settings. However, approximately 15 to 25% of patients ultimately relapse. So, you know, the onus is on us really to kind of find more effective therapies for those patients. Well, HER2-positive breast cancer is heterogeneous, and different patients benefit from different treatment approaches. The identification of accurate and reproducible biomarkers of response and resistance will be important in terms of being able to tailor treatment more effectively going forward. And again, it is, you know, treatment de-escalation is feasible and important, and really the majority of patients benefit only a slight degree from the addition of newer HER2-targeted treatment regimens in the adjuvant setting.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 28th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have several upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to hear more about the treatment landscape of gastrointestinal malignancies, consider registering for the February 21st State of the Science Summit in Washington, D.C. We will also be hosting a State of the Science Summit on February 26th in Durham, North Carolina, which is also focused on GI malignancies. To check out the list of upcoming meetings or to register, go to onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.